All right, it's 3:15. Good afternoon. There should be a that sign up for that email list going around, and
the attendee list.
So, according to my friend Chip, you need to look and make sure that your email address is correct, so that you don't want to get the wrong.
All the numbers, all the letters.
Anything else, Chip?
That's it.
Okay, good. And we're all selling this to the highest bidder. Just want you to know. All right. Well, our next speaker is Paul Helfrich, and I am delighted to introduce Paul. I've been an admirer of Paul's project ever since I heard him at the Colorado Seth conference. And you can see that he also, along with knowing a lot of cool stuff, Paul also knows how to present cool stuff. And so I, for one, am particularly interested in hearing his presentation, and so welcome.
Thank you very much. The first thing I'd like to say today is I want to dedicate my talk to the memory of a dear friend, Carol Funk, who passed away in early January, was a longtime member of the Colorado SET Conference. Second, I would like to thank Lawrence Davidson for inviting me to speak today. And thirdly, I'd like to thank all of you for being here and sharing this with me. I'm going to be talking about a book project of mine that I've spoken a little bit about in the last 6 months called SET, The Ultimate Guide. Today, I like to give an overview when I talk, so I'm going to start with a little bit about me, my background and interests, some backstory on the book's creation. Then I'm going to spend a bunch of time on a general overview of the content of the book. And whenever I talk, I like to do musical interludes. It just gives the cognitive mind time to rest and put a nice pretty picture up and some music that I've composed. That's why you see iTunes, CD Baby, and Rhapsody. It's available for download for 99 cents on there if you're interested. And we'll finish with some questions. If I have to use one word to describe my intent, purpose, and desire in this life, it really can be summed up as an educator. I spent 7 years in academic music. That's my background. Teaching in the classroom at the undergraduate level. I spent 10 years at the Franklin Institute Science Museum in Philadelphia, where I learned to teach informal science education. I designed hands-on exhibits and other outreach programs using the internet and partnering with K-8 schools. I ran a national testbed project between 6 science museums and K-8 schools. And I've always taken a multidisciplinary approach to what I've done. And I forgot to mention, the last 12 years, it's pretty much been a retreat sort of existence in Santa Clarita, Castaic, where I live, where I've been immersed in the Seth material, perennial philosophy, developmental psychology, doing a Morgan in a way of reading, researching, teaching a little bit, speaking a little bit. And what I'm actually looking forward to doing in my next phase is get a certification as a Waldorf teacher, where I hopefully will be teaching K to 12 kids, because there's no mandatory retirement age for a Waldorf teacher. It's a private school, and they were founded by Rudolf Steiner, or Steiner, if you say it with a European accent. Needless to say, this comes with the territory, love of the Seth material. There's 28 Seth books out there with the first two volumes of the ESP class sessions coming out. And does anybody know how many more volumes are due to come out of the ESP class books?
As far as I know, there's 2 more, and it'll stop where the tapes start.
Okay, so there's at least 2 more. So the milieu may finish with 30 Seth books. And then, of course, there's more by Jane Roberts. And these are books that I've been in love with since 1976 when I first read Seth Speaks. And I always love hearing other people and speakers talk about how they came into it, what their first Seth was. Because it's essentially the same startling recognition of something very important and true being reflected in the books. And that's universal. I also ran the SethNet email list as a moderator for almost 11 years. We just shut it down last August of 2009. And that's because my path and time there was wrapping up. Looking back over the 11 years, I really spent a lot of time immersed in it, debating it, teaching it, learning about it, and learning how to moderate a group, an online community. And there's a whole longer story to SethNet, and who knows, maybe someday I'll talk about that. I managed the New Worldview website since 2000. We founded that with Michael Steffen, Linda Dahl, Mary Rowan, Stan Lukowski, and my wife, Jo Helfrich, in 1999. And we did some conferences, and then gradually partners dropped out. It was Michael, Jo, and I. We carried the torch for a while, then it was Jo and I. And pretty much it's just I. It gets to a point where I am not enough, and it's time to move on. So that I wanted to point out the New Worldview website, newworldview.com, is not going away. It's a tremendous resource, and I've had conversations with some of you here, so I just wanted to mention it. In fact, Jenny over breakfast today from Austin is setting up a Seth meetup locally, and she wanted some information on how to run a local meetup in question. So there's several articles in our library. There, if you go to the library, there's 7 rooms in there: Society of Mass Events, Science and Technology, Conscious Creation, a reference section where we've got the best indices, and all online resources of the Seth material in there. And so I encourage you to check it out. Use the search function to do that. And send me an email if you're researching something. I have Mary Dillman's categorization of all the sessions, all the indices, and so on. Freely available there. And tons of other stuff. Theoretical stuff as well. So when I spoke to Lawrence a couple weeks ago about what he wanted me to talk about, he was working on this legacy and issue, and we as a community are graying and getting longer in the tooth, so to speak, and what do we leave behind us, and how do we move this on to the next generation. I've been really happy today to see Paul's group up here of students and Morgan's wonderful talk as an adult coming through now and looking back on her adolescence through this, and you know, adolescence was tough on all of us. So in my own case, the legacy, of course, is the New Worldview work and that website that's there. But I wrote a book on the Seth material to provide an overview or an introduction to my version of what I think are the essential core elements of the Seth material. So, of course, I create my own book. And you should have a TM on that for your I create. I thought of that, you know. But it was like, oh, I should use that now instead of just capitalize space create. But that's Morgan and Dawn's company. So I've always been following the beat of a different drummer. I talked about that last year. And the 9 families of consciousness, right? Just a show of hands, you're vaguely familiar with Seth's 9 families to some extent. Okay, good. A good number of you. Well, my background, what always resonated with me is the Sumathi intent, which is passing on original knowledge with least distortion. And it's the teachers, all through. And there's Sumathi here always. And so this is my intent. I want you to understand that as you go through this book and get exposed to it, that it really is done with my background as an educator and trying to, you know, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink as a teacher. But you can make the water as enticing, the Kool-Aid as enticing as possible. But eventually they must drink it themselves and then feedback on their interpretation of that experience. So at the 2008 Colorado Seth Conference, I met Bob Friedman, who's a publisher at Hampton Roads, and he published Conversations with God. Just again, another show of hands, you've heard of Conversations with God, that's about half of you. It was a big New Age hit, and a whole series of books came out. And Bob heard me speak there, and he came up to me after lunch and getting to know me and Joanne a little bit, and asked me to write a dummy's guide for the Seth material. It's like, dummy's guide, huh? Well, That was just a publishing, you know, piece of jargon, because it can be insulting, the dummy's guide. Can you even write a dummy's guide to the Seth material? No, you can't, right? You can't. You need a certain cognitive development to start getting into the map and the practices and going through it. So he said, I want you to write this book. And the conference came and went in September. And a couple of months passed, and he calls me in December, and he says, hey, Paul, how you doing with the book? And I'm like, oh, you were serious? I was so blown away. It's like, okay, he's interested, but he didn't really follow up. And I didn't have an agent or any experience in the publishing industry, really. And I, you know, didn't follow up with him because my own trajectory took me in other places. So he said, send me an outline and I'll send you a contract. So I did that. I spent a couple days and I wrote an outline, 16 chapters. And the interesting part in the process of writing this book, that outline only had one additional chapter inserted, chapter 10, and chapters, what originally were 6 and 7, got condensed into one chapter. So the way I saw it all the way through kind of panned out, because I've been teaching this for so long. So this wasn't something that I did on the spur of the moment. In January of 2009, I sent out a questionnaire to the New Worldview mailing list, and I got 95 responses. Now, out of 4,000 emails, you know, that's a small percentage, but that's about typical, really, with an email list. And I got all kinds of wonderful responses. In fact, the vast majority were very supportive. Of course, there was one, which is always funny to me in hindsight, but at the time I said, you know, basically the subtext of this email was, who the fuck do you think you are? You can't write a Seth book. Nobody can write a Seth book. Only Seth can write a Seth book. Fair and valid perspective. Okay, fine. But the other 94 were like, this is great. We've needed this for so long. And here's a list of things I think you should have. And I asked specific questions. What themes? What are the basic core things? And I might have limited it. Say, what were the 5 or 6 core ideas you think should be included? And based on that feedback, you know, I was in pretty good shape. There were a couple of things, 2 things that stood out that I hadn't thought of in the outline. And one was our relationship with animals, because there's a lot of wonderful information on animals in the Seth material. And a woman named Judy Hensel had put together tons of quotes and approached Amber Allen and tried to get them interested in publishing a Seth book on animals, and that never worked out. But she sent me that outline, so I had that as a resource. And then another woman was asking for her daughter, who was in, you know, about suicide. What happens when you commit suicide? And that was something I hadn't really thought of. And it's in The Way Toward Health. There's some beautiful, beautiful information on suicide in there. So that got put into the outline as well. So I took a Socratic approach to this, which is basically Q&A, question and answer. There's nothing written down in Socratic dialogue. The teacher and students engage a series of questions and answers in collaborative inquiry. So throughout this book, I ask over 100 questions. As a chapter header, not a chapter header, I'm sorry, section headers. And then there's a page or three that attempts to explicate that. Of course, you have to include exercises in there and make it experiential as well. And I just did, from my perspective and my own path, my own practice, what I consider to be one way, a core way, to get started in doing Sethian practices. It's flexible, as you will find out in time, that you can adapt this and do it and add things and subtract things to it, which is kind of neat as well. The original working title that I came up with was Seth Revealed, because I had this sense of revealing the secrets of the Seth material. And it's also revelatory material as well. I think Paul was talking about that yesterday. Revelation from the theological perspective. Revealed material. This is revealed material. Of course, the publishers didn't like the title and came up with this one, Seth, the Ultimate Guide. And there's a nice double entendre in there, because he is the ultimate teacher in a sense. And then if this is comprehensive, it's an ultimate and comprehensive guide to the Seth material. There's 3 major sections in this book. And the way I've always taught this and talked about it and introducing it is, you know, yourself, your world, and how we can all get along. Those are the 3 core dimensions of being in any philosophical system. And I intuited that when I had to give a radio interview back in 2001. Someone from the SethNet email list called up their local radio station in South Africa and asked them to have me as a speaker, which they agreed to do. So I had to, you know, I was going to do an overview of the Seth material for the first time. And I came, you know, as I meditated and thought about this, self, world, and how we can all get along. And I ended up intuiting something very core that structurally works throughout. These are some of the questions and ideas that are explored in the introductory section. That's not part of the three main sections of the book. But this is an overview. It was interesting, Adrian's comment about not leading with channeling in some ways when you're teaching this to a younger audience and whatnot. And again, this is a flexible thing, but in this section is where these questions are asked. What is the set material? What is channeling? And there's some just pithy information given with resources and citations that shows that it's part of the perennial wisdom tradition, for example. I didn't learn this until 1995 when I read Norm Friedman's book, Bridging Science and Spirit. I'd never heard of the perennial tradition. I had a music education and a science thing going on and not a philosophical or theological background. Who or what is Seth? Paul mentioned, Jane's aspect term of personagram. Seth referred to himself as a bridge personality that was neither Seth and neither Jane, but a hybrid. This is something that I think is really important when you're teaching this level of the phenomena of what channeling is, that the Seth we know, the voice we hear, is not Seth. It's a hybrid. It's a temporary existing personality gram that's there using Jane's vocabulary, Jane's cultural awareness, of course his own, and I think of it as a galaxy squeezing through a straw coming out of Jane's mouth. This vast intelligence with access to vast amounts of information, knowledge, and power. The controversial question, can anyone else channel Seth? Seth says over and over that there are no closed systems. So from my perspective, theoretically, the answer to that question is yes. However, Seth was unequivocal that he would never come through any other source but Jane, and it's on the record at least two places in the early sessions, volume 9, to maintain the integrity of the material. And so when people claim to be channeling Seth, I always counsel them, call it anything but Seth. Call it whatever you want, but don't call it Seth, because I am 99.999% certain it is not Seth. But no absolutes, so you never know what can happen down the road. But for now, I'm on the record as saying no, no one else can channel Seth. I also mentioned other sources. I mentioned Abraham and the Hickses. I mentioned Daryl Ankin Bashar, Serge Grandbois, who channels Chris, as examples of other sources who've been available for decades who are influenced by the Seth material. And then I also mentioned Mary Ennis, who channels Elias, who claims to be an expansion or enhancement of the Seth material itself. And I've done a website called eliasforum.org that has transcripts and other work. And I wrote a controversial essay that I published in 1999, I think I released it in S2K in New Haven, about the relationship between Seth and Elias, and then leave it up to you to decide, is this fraud? Is this valid? Is there a grain of truth here? What is the connection with Seth? And then I close the introduction with a little bit about worldviews. And just very quickly, most of us know a worldview in terms of the William James and Cezanne and Rembrandt material, where worldviews are the individual's energy deposit somewhere in framework 2 or 3 or thereabouts that can be accessed. The way I'm defining it in this book is as follows. Uh, I'm using it in a collective sense from a sociological perspective for my storytelling and organizing in some parts throughout the book. And it's short and sweet, so it's not overdone. Joanne edited both copies of the book for me, and I'll talk more about them later, to keep it short and simple and keep it in the narrative moving along. But the traditional worldview is basically the religious worldview, the Jerry Falwell, the Billy Grahams of the world. And the modern worldview can be characterized as the scientific one. And in Sethian terms, Freudian, Darwinian, those belief systems, materialism, there is no soul, there's no need for a God or any other causal agent, that random chance, meaninglessness implied, is characterized as the modern worldview collectively. And the postmodern worldview, I'm not using that word in terms of the French school, the French philosophers, Foucault, Derrida, Lacan, and those guys. But that's a linguistic, philosophical thing. I'm using it in a very general, catch-all way of whatever the hell is coming next. What Linda was talking about is the new civilization, that we're exiting modernity and going through the birth pangs, and it's a non-linear, uneven, up-and-down process with a lot of changes going on. But what Jean Gebser, who was a sociologist, a Swiss anthropologist as well, he saw that there was an unfolding of these collective worldview systems, and that followed a sort of, each subsequent stage is built upon the one that preceded it. So there's a seedling, sapling, tree in framework one only, okay? Because this gets into that difficult, slippery term of hierarchy and how it functions in framework one terms. That the way I'm using it is as seedling, sapling, tree, whatever that is. And Seth says the seed, the matter in the seed doesn't turn into the matter in the sapling. There is another thing, that's this whole multidimensional backbone of CUs and EEs and all that other business that is part of the growth process. But for us, in linear terms, there's this unfolding. So it's an organizing principle throughout the book. So as each worldview unfolds, it creates new challenges that can only be solved by more sophisticated perspectives, where risk, regression, and arrest. And there's a well-known Einstein quote that the problems we face today cannot be solved by the level of thinking that created them. And here's Seth's take on this. Consciousness, by its nature, expands continually. The nature of consciousness, as you understand it, as a species, will, in one way or another, lead you beyond your limited ideas of reality, for your experience will set challenges that cannot be solved within your current framework. Those problems set by one level of consciousness will automatically cause breakthroughs into other areas of conscious activity where solutions can be found. And so the working hypothesis here is that what I'm calling the emerging new worldview is certainly the energetic process of that unfolding happening. Part one, discover your true self. You know, what were the first words that Seth said in the early ESP class books, basically to those guys that showed up in the 60s? You are more than you know. And that's just an entree into multidimensional personality. The way I tackle this is with an iceberg analogy. The tip of the iceberg is the outer ego. The surface between air and water is the subconscious mediating level. And then the big, vast, submerged portion is the entity layer. And that's how I introduce multidimensional personality. But I also ask a question, and it's really a Zen koan. And the question is, who is the you, in quotes, who creates all of your reality? Who are you? Who am I? And there's no definitive answer to that. That's something we'll explore and go back and forth over and over. And we've been doing, continue doing, it's part of our development through our reincarnational cycles. I also introduced the inner senses in this first chapter and the nine families of consciousness. I mentioned that for most Sethis are not overly familiar with the nine families and their uses. I'm more familiar with them because of the Elias material that I've been involved in, and he's explicated a lot of information there. The net result of the families is that it helps you with your own soul intent. When you ask yourself, why am I here? What is my purpose in life? Understanding the families as a typology, like the Enneagram or Myers-Briggs, can give you a clue into why you're here and maybe what you want to do in life as you find your way through this complex modern and postmodern world of ours. chapter 2, we get into conscious creation right away. And the way I organized this was to begin with the metaphysics of conscious creation, because a lot of it is metaphysical. And just the iceberg analogy itself and entity, these are metaphysical speculations as we introduce them. Then there's a physics of reality creation, consciousness units, EEs, and that connection with quantum mechanics. Then there's a biology of reality creation. It talks a lot about cellular reality and how cellular in your body, how it remembers every injury you've ever had in your leg is stored there and is connected through the cellular memory and, of course, the frameworks of consciousness. And then finally, the psychology of reality and creation, which gets into beliefs, thoughts, emotions, expectations, dreaming. And it's a much bigger, most of the set material deals with the psychology of reality and creation. But these are just nice organizing principles to start to help unpack the material in other ways as you go through. So there's more in belief work there. Chapter 3, love, gender, and sex. It's where value fulfillment is introduced early on. As divine love, that's my term, but it's an accurate term. It's the expression of all that is great love for all of its creations and trying to promote the best fulfillment for all of them in relationship to each other. Gender, of course, male and female, and our innate bisexuality. The Seth material is wonderful because it says if you're gay or lesbian or bi or tri or quadra or whatever, it's perfectly natural. It is not pathological. It is not something you can unlearn. Of course, with the power of beliefs, you can manipulate your consciousness in any way you want. And of course, sex, being dealing with gender and sexual preference. So these are introduced in it. Of course, you have to love yourself before you can love others. Then we get into the unlimited power of dreams and dreaming, and introduce the dreaming self, dream recall, dream journaling, set sleep habits, dietary recommendations, therapeutic dreams, true dreams from the gates of Horn, the body, probable selves, and also dream art science is mentioned here. And it's a very sophisticated future attractor from the unknown reality that belongs here, because it's where this emerging new world view, I believe, is headed in the next 100 to 1,000 or 5,000 years. And Seth talks about the high intellect, a superb blend of intellect, cognitive rationality, the rational approach, and deep intuitions, or the magical approach, but blended together into the high intellect. And to me, that sets the bar in terms of dream work and other things. And therefore, I approach this really as a spiritual science. And when we start to do practices with dream work, this is a spiritual science, which there's three basic parts to the scientific method. One, come up with a hypothesis, or theory. Two, do an experiment or an injunction or a practice to test that theory. And three, compare the results of that experiment with others to verify or falsify it. There is a dream art science that Seth talks about. It's being done by people. Robert Monroe, dream art scientist. Rudolf Steiner, the Waldorf School, dream art scientist. Bruce Mohn, who's a Monroe graduate, dream art science. Has anybody heard of Frank Keppel in the UK out there? He's not really well known. Dream art scientist. So these people have been out here in the last century, you know, manifesting, doing their work, but not from a secular perspective. Here's where we examine birth, death, and reincarnation. And there's a whole lot of information there. And I am running out of time, so self, our multidimensional self. The next section, discover your place in the world. Seth emphasizes individual reality, and we always come back to the individual. But we find out in practice and experience that we are in fact creating in relationship. As Kirsten and I were talking about earlier today, it's an I-thou. There's, you know, it's not just I exist by myself. So this section tries to get into that. And it begins, therefore, with Seth's creation myth, before the beginning, from dreams, evolution, and value. We introduce the sleepwalkers there, the order of play, the Garden of Eden metaphor, which is the awakening of the outer ego, has been reflected in our myths of leaving the Garden of Eden. That's where we left the dream time, or the dream reality as we created before the beginning into physical reality. Then we introduce frameworks of consciousness. There's four frameworks of consciousness, but most of it's frameworks one and two. Three and four are there briefly, and there's more we can talk about, but it's in the book. And I want to get through a lot of this somewhat quickly now. I mentioned master events, which are fuel, divine vitality expressed as a type of fuel in framework two that fuels all mass events. And Seth calls them master events. And I also introduce alpha states here and a way to explore alpha states, because that is a gateway into framework two and beyond. The alpha state teaching is really beautiful, and I think we barely scratched the surface on its potentials, and it's a beautiful map. And speaking of master events, the Christ drama was a master event. So there's a whole chapter on the Christ material, of course, the role of the speakers, what religious dramas are all about, the central themes, the return of Paul, the crucifixion or non-crucifixion, and a way of looking at and making meaning out of why did Seth choose the Messiah myth? Why did Seth pick the Messiah myth and put his interpretation of the three Christs, John the Baptist, the historical Jesus, and Paul or Saul of Tarsus, plus the 12 disciples, plus the teacher of righteousness. This is all from chapter 21 of Seth Speaks. 16 Christs, fragments, personalities in this whole thing. Chapter 9, Lost Civilizations, A Dream City, and UFOs, Oh My, Lions and Tigers and Bears. Romania, Atlantis, The Dream City, Aliens, Alien Technology from the deleted sessions. What they have in common, as I was researching this, is that they're looking at a way to introduce simultaneous time, reincarnation, probabilities, and all the subtlety. So he used all of these as teaching examples to give us direct experience with these things. And then closing out this section, what is the relationship of animals? Because we did not evolve from apes. Because in simultaneous time before the beginning, every life form that ever will be or ever could be exists already. Everything exists already, nested together as potential, pure potential. And yet there's then endless variation of new potential coming out of that. So in framework one terms, there is an order of play. You have to create a planet first that a biosphere can emerge to support cellular life, sexual reproduction. Cellular reproduction begins to happen at a low level, builds up in time. That becomes the food for the other dream elements to come in their physical bodies and start to eat that and eat each other and build up and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of paradox. Seth uses paradox frequently to try to introduce these multidimensional framework too, and further inward, as I think of it, parts. This is how ignorance, hatred, and violence get perpetuated, right? We teach our young ones. I'm guessing he's about 6 or 7 years old. He's a British soccer fan, and he's just giving the other team the old what for, you know. How can we all live in harmony? So I begin with a rather original part of the book, the synthesis of the moral or ethical view in the Seth material. Now, Seth did not outline a moral theory or present anything in a formal sense. I pulled together pieces and put this together my own way. It starts to look at the natural laws, the 11 laws of the inner universe. Remember some of those valuable films? It was the first one. Consciousness, spontaneity, quality, depth, infinite mobility of consciousness, and things like this, that every CU, every consciousness unit has these characteristics. Divine love, a value fulfillment is there, infinite propensity for new development. And he also says in his creation myth that there's an ethical component to CUs that's inherent. There's an innate morality. It's not fixed, it's not absolute, but it's innate within all that is. And Sethics, the term, was created by J.C. Mackin on the SethNet email list. So I'm honoring his creation. He asked this question, what was Seth's moral theory? What would you say? And we couldn't answer it 10 years ago when he asked that question. And it took me 10 years to come up and refine it and work it. And it's just condensed down into a small chapter now. But basically we get into Seth's idea of natural guilt and violation, natural aggression, natural grace. And through violation and our sense of how that unfolds within our own stages of development as a human being, there's an innate sense of right and wrong. And violation, it's a beautiful teaching of Seth's. It says that when we violate, there's no cosmic punishment. There's no eternal punishment for that. But there's a knowing that, ouch, because we can look back and we have a type of conscience, although he calls conscience artificial guilt. There's a type of natural guilt that says, I shouldn't pull the legs off that spider ever again. You know, I shouldn't rape that woman or anyone ever again. It was horrible. And in a healthy sense, you move on, you heal, and whatever. And it's a very complex area of the Seth material. But that leads us then into the nature of good and evil. And why do bad things happen to good people? Is a nice question another Zen koan to ask. And notice I put happen to in quotes. And basically, catch yourself doing that, because nothing happens to us. If we create 100% of our reality, nothing happens to us. We don't catch a cold. We create a cold. Create a car accident. And it's hard to do that. And Morgan, I think, spoke eloquently to how she wrestled with that through all of her ups and downs in her teenage years. Then we get into birth defects, incurable diseases, handicaps, natural disasters, suicide, and the question, do you create your own death? Well, if you create your own reality, you're going to create your own death. And it's a healthy thing in every spiritual tradition to do practices and exercises to embrace, fully embrace your own death and participate in it, if possible, in whatever way you can. That leads us into practicing idealism. But what's interesting in mass events, what's mixed throughout that, you know, conflict, war, disease, do you live in a safe universe is explored in that chapter. And of course, we have to look at Jonestown and Three Mile Island as examples that Seth talked about. Jonestown of religious fanaticism, Three Mile Island of scientific fanaticism. And then, of course, Hitler's Germany, which is the perfect storm of religious and scientific fanaticism unleashed in a horrific way across a world disaster conflagration. And then, of course, how to become a practicing idealist and what's involved. And the essential thing is you begin where you are and you move from there. And you can do whatever works for your intent. If you want to be the best janitor in the world, be the best at whatever you want to be. This is one of the conditions for us being here, is agreeing to develop our abilities to the fullest. So there is, I believe, a moral imperative and challenge to us when Seth says, we've never told anybody to do anything but face up to the abilities of consciousness. And that is a huge challenge. It's huge. It's the hero's journey. It's the fuel that pushes you out of the birdcage, out of the nest, into the raw, big, crazy world and the rapids and the earthquakes and the ups and downs. And through adversity, learning to cope and deal with that. And hopefully pass some of that along afterwards. The penultimate chapter, I honor Jane's work and her Three Aspects book. Because, and I mentioned a little bit about the James material in here and his critiques of Freud and Darwin. And, of course, we deal with the codicils, the God of Jane, the American vision. These are beautiful teachings that capture a lot of things that she wrote so eloquently on. And it gives Jane's voice, makes Jane's voice present in the book. And, of course, our heroine dies at the end of the chapter. The final question is, why is Jane Roberts' death important? And in a nutshell, it's because we have something we can all learn from Jane's choice of death. It's natural to project our own fear of death on any death we experience. And we think, oh, Jane, you know, her choices were her choices. I'm not going to do that. If I were her, I would have got up and walked. I would have. That's all ego talking. That's all ego, whose job it is to protect you and make you happy and healthy and get through physical reality framework one, fear of being annihilated through the death experience. And we know, I know as a fact, that there is no death. And I know that through my 34 years of spiritual practice, my own altered focus. I've talked a little bit about that yesterday. I stand before you stating this unequivocally as a fact, that there is no death. I leave this body, this glove I'm wearing, and I continue elsewhere, as does Jane. And therefore, we can use her death as a great teaching tool, I believe. And it also adds transparency to approaching the material, because death is a taboo subject, and it's difficult. And finding a way to confront that is really important. And then the secret finally gets revealed in chapter 15, the final chapter. And you'll have to buy the book to find that out. No, I'll tell you a little bit, of course, about that. I start with the magical approach in there. And I reread that for the fourth or fifth time last summer on our vacation in Maui, in a beautiful little town called Hamoa Beach in Hana. And of course, every time you reread the book, you get something new out of it. And I realized that Seth was emphasizing the magical approach because he's emphasizing the inner senses and deep intuitions and emotions and feelings on the intuitive side. And that's what the magical approach does once we unequivocally agree to open to it and use it. But it also is meant to complement the rational approach. And if you come back to the high intellect, it's about rationality and deep intuition or inner senses. So we have the magical approach, we have the rational approach. The larger organizing principle is what he calls the natural approach. And there's only a couple of quotes in there where it's very clear, and I'd love to see Linda's take on it, to see if it's as very clear to her as it is to me, that this is the natural approach is what he's really telling us to do. But the point is, we're so into the rational approach, he has to emphasize the magical approach. So there's a lot of information on the magical approach and how to start to use that. But overall, we're synthesizing a new cognitive ability and a way to solve problems and a way to create our reality even more effectively. And let's see, is this one next year? The Seth material as a Rosetta Stone of Consciousness. I am really proud to present this diagram because I've been using a version of it from Houston Smith's Forgotten Truth. He's a preeminent religious scholar in this country. I believe he's still alive. He's in his 80s. And it was also a version of this was done in Ken Wilber's A Theory of Everything. And it was a way to organize the traditions. And the way to look at this diagram, in the upper left here, we have the exteriors, levels of reality. So framework one represents the outsideness of reality creation. This side, if this is our dividing line, and of course this is all that we have need to say about Taoism, right? We don't even put words in for Taoism. It's represented as this symbol in the center. But down here, the levels of self is about all the interiority and the nested interiority within all that is. And the really cool thing, and it took me years to come up with this, to be able to, dare I, put the Seth material next to the world's religions. And yeah, I do. And I stand by this in my own 34 years of experimentation and verifying these things. You know, in framework one, the outer ego rules. Frameworks 2, 3, and 4, this is where our entity aspect is residing. There is a construct called life cloud that was presented in Dreams, Evolution, and Value Film. It's way at the end, and Jane's dying, and there's all these notes, and it comes and goes. There's never been much discussion, but I've triangulated this through other the world's religions and other bodies of channeled work, including Chris, Elias, and Rose, as channeled by my wife. Rob used the term dream cloud, and I use that to represent the interiority gestalt at this nested layer of all that is. And of course we use all that is to represent the totality. So this graph is two-dimensional, it's flat, it's distorted as hell, but it's a way to introduce and show that if you go to these other traditions, you'll find these words and these terms. And this again is Houston Smith's interpretation. This is just a ballpark, a way to organize these different things and say, all that is all that is. What is real and true and good and beautiful has always been. We've been trying to map it and interpret it into our own cultural context and present it in different ways. And here is how the Seth material maps to the world's religions. This is just representing cats and geese in the Seth material. There's a 15 to 20 page glossary of terms and concepts, the nine intersenses, an updated bibliography of all of Jane's work and its present publisher's publications so you can buy the books. And then, of course, it mentions the California Seth Conference and other related things, and channeled books, the Channeling Zone by Brown, and Klimo's book, and Arthur Hastings' book. And, of course, family and friends and other seekers to the Seth material, the next generation of Seth readers, first and foremost. Secondarily, to refresh, revisit, and explore the Seth material, for all of us to revisit this thing in a comprehensive way, to connect the dots in new ways and deepen your own personal practice, using local study groups as an entirety. The 16 chapters flow right into each other. You can do your own course based on that. You can pull your own Seth quotes, your own favorites, and integrate them in there. It's a nice sort of jazz framework for improvisation or teaching improvisation that you can do on your own. And again, I always like to say that we have only begun to unpack the Seth material. It's less than 50 years old. I think we've just scratched the surface and the map and the practices. And a final thought on this. I got one more slide to get through. I sent this to friends and colleagues around the country, and I was really delighted by the feedback that I got and the testimonials that I got. They were just wonderful. And I want to point out that with John Klimo, Stanley Krippner, and Arthur Hastings are three of the senior preeminent transpersonal psychologists in the channeling field, and they're all avid Seth fans and Seth readers. And I think part of the reason they were so enthusiastic in their testimonials is because this book is so needed, so desperately needed. Elizabeth Sartoris is a biologist. Fred Allenwolf is a physicist. And the rest are metaphysicians and metaphysical teachers. Please contact me. My email address will be on here so that you're on the mailing list to get updates. I hope to do a little promotion to launch the book and make it an Amazon bestseller. So the idea is to get all of you, if you're interested in it, to buy it at the same 24-hour period, drive the numbers up, and it can get some legs and some excitement, some marketing about it. There will be a revised New Worldview website coming to help promote this, and we're developing online courses that will probably be offered in 2011 based on the book. But the good thing about it, you can just take the book in your own study group and use it yourself if you're comfortable doing that as well. If you want to go deeper and explore, you know, advanced intermediate stuff, I'm going to be teaching that course. And with our friend Chris Johnson in the UK and my wife Joanne and others, we're developing a curriculum to make this available online and in person as well. So please join me on Facebook. Just friend me. And I'm more active on Facebook now since I closed down my forums. And I know we're out of time, so I have to leave it up to Lawrence if you want to end here. That's
no questions.
Do we have time for questions?
Not a lot of time, okay. But sometime. Yeah.
Two questions. Two questions?
I have three, so forget it.
I'm sorry, Vicki said, but did the artwork?
Oh, the artwork is by a bunch of different sources. This is, it's spelled Y-E-R-K-E-S. He's a surrealist painter. I love his stuff. I have a bunch of it. But there are other images that I've used, and there are citations on them. And you can see me afterwards. I'll give you that information. Anybody else? All righty then. Thank you so much.